This morning, we're going to be reading from John 3, starting with the first verse, and it starts this way. The elder, to my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Dear friends, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. It gave me great joy to have some brothers come and tell about your faithfulness to the truth and how you continue to walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. Dear friends, you are faithful in what you are doing for your brothers. Even though they are strangers to you, they have told the church about your love. You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from pagans. We ought therefore to show hospitality to such men so that they may work together for the truth.
This third letter of John is one of the shortest in the New Testament, and one of those books that we just kind of tend to ignore. In fact, I don't think I've ever preached a sermon on 3 John before. But what a mistake that it's been, because it has so much to say to us. It's a warm and honest pastoral letter, one of those straight-from-the-shoulder messages from a pastor to his people, and where encouragement and commendation are deserved, they are given, and when confrontation is needed, it's not glossed over, but it is dealt with in an honest and a forthright manner. The writer doesn't identify himself as John the Apostle, but only as the elder. It's likely that he was so well known at this point, and his authority was so well recognized, that he could use this title without any further explanation. Everyone knew who the elder was. The Apostle John is believed to have lived to a ripe old age. Over the long period of his exercising pastoral care in Ephesus and then his exile to the island of Patmos, it's believed that he lived into the beginning of the second century. And he would have been intimately acquainted with the affairs of churches throughout the province of Asia. And he would have been acknowledged by the local Christian communities as having spiritual oversight. Now, there were other elders in the church, but because of John's great age and his position as the last one of the apostles, it was believed that all the other apostles were martyred, but John remained alive. He was in a unique position. He was the elder. John is writing a very personal and actually a quite frank letter. It's largely made up of an assessment of 3 people that he knew in the church. And this kind of personal assessment happens even today in large organizations where the chief executive can't possibly know everybody, and so a person's immediate superior is often in a position to write an appraisal of both the employee's abilities or shortcomings and dealing with his personal qualities and his work. A school teacher makes the same kind of assessment when he or she writes out a pupil's report card at the end of a term. Now, these reports are usually confidential and only available to the person being assessed. But in this case, John's assessment is published to the whole world for all eternity. This is also to be the case at Christ's judgment seat when Christians are rewarded or confronted about their service to him. At that moment, the secrets of all hearts will be disclosed. 2 Corinthians 5:10 tells about this. It says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each of us may receive what is due us for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad." The Apostle Paul writes to the Corinthian believers that all their actions and their motives will one day be judged. And they fall into basically one of 2 categories. 1 Corinthians 3:12 says, "If any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames." So there is what is judged to be valuable, what he calls the gold, the silver, the costly stones, or that which is basically worthless, the wood, the hay, and the stubble. I sometimes wonder how my appraisal is going to read. It's a pretty sobering thought. In our earthly life, God leaves us to get on with the job of building our lives for his glory. He may influence influence us through his Spirit, but he doesn't force us against our will. We act under our own responsibility. We are free agents of our own destiny. But after life's short journey is ended, at the day of Christ, each person's work will become manifest. It will be an examination by fire, the most severe and searching scrutiny that anyone has ever experienced. When students are preparing for examinations, they are often encouraged to refer to previous examination papers to get an idea of what they can expect and see the standards that are being set. So this is kind of what John is showing us here in this letter from the elder to the people. So let's take advantage of his assessment of these three people that he mentioned. It's our opportunity to notice those qualities that are commended and that will survive that fiery trial and go on to be rewarded. It will also warn us away from those character defects that will result in our life's work being burned up and causing us to suffer loss. And in the process of that evaluation, we can see even now that our actions, our words, our motives can have a dramatic impact on others. And that's why these things must be evaluated. The first person that John assesses is Gaius. We see in the assessment of Gaius is that he was a person who served others. There are several men named Gaius that appear in the pages of the New Testament. There was a Gaius in Corinth, and this man acted as host to Paul, and it seems that the local church met in his house. Then there was a man named Gaius in Derbe, who accompanied Paul on his last missionary journey through Greece. And both of these were true servants of Christ. But the name Gaius was quite common at that time in the Roman Empire, and so John's letter could have been addressed to another person that's not otherwise mentioned in the New Testament. So we're not sure exactly who this Gaius was. But from the way that John writes, it's clear that Gaius occupied a position of responsibility and leadership in the local church. But John also knew him on a quite personal level as well. He writes with great warmth in his greeting, "To my dear friend Gaius." It's possible that Gaius may owe his conversion to John, because he writes that nothing gives him greater joy than to hear that his children are living by the truth. And so Gaius represented no problem to John. In fact, the elder is able to repeat a testimonial that he received from the Christians who had visited Gaius' church. And on the return to the elder, they brought back a good report on Gaius. And they said basically that he abounded in spiritual health. By the way that is worded, it may have been that Gaius was physically unwell, and in fact that the elder prays that his friend might enjoy good health. But whatever might have been going on with his physical condition, his spirit was aglow. It was well with his soul, as the choir sang. He may have been poor materially, and most Christians were in those days, but his soul was brimming over with spiritual life and vitality. This is the standard that God's looking for, because it's what Jesus has made possible for us. It's why he came, to give us life, that we might have life and have it more abundantly, as John 10:10 says. It isn't God's intention that we should live our lives in a state of paralysis. So no matter what our physical circumstances might be, no matter how ill we are, how poor we are, we're not to be paralyzed spiritually. Another plus point for Gaius is that he practiced what he preached. The testimonial by the visiting Christians referring to Gaius's consistency in the Christian life talks about this. Not only did he believe the truth of the gospel, that he also lived out what he believed. When Paul wrote to the young minister Titus, he urged him to teach his people to conduct themselves so that in every respect they might adorn the doctrine of Jesus Christ. He wanted their actions to speak so loudly that even the pagans would have to exclaim, "If this is what the Christian religion does for them, it must be wonderful. It must be something that I want." There's a popular poem you probably heard, but I think it fits very well right here, which says, "I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather one would walk with me than merely show the way. The eye's a better pupil and more willing than the ear. Fine counsel is confusing, but example's always clear. And the best of all the preachers are the ones who live their creeds. For to see good put in action is what everybody needs. I soon can learn to do it if you let me see it done. I can watch your hands in action, but your tongue too fast may run. And the sermon you deliver may be very wise and true, but I'd rather get my lesson by observing what you do. For I might misunderstand you and the high advice you give, but there's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live." I think one of the best compliments I ever received was from a lady from our last church who, when she was saying goodbye to me, said, "You not only preached it, but you lived it." I can only hope that that was the truth, because it really doesn't do anyone any good to preach a life if you don't live it. We don't know if Gaius was a preacher, but the sermon that his life preached ran true. John's assessment was that he walked in the truth. There was no conflict between what he professed and what he practiced. Rather, there was a complete harmony between his creed and his conduct. Not only that, but we see that Gaius used his time and his resources in Christian service. John singles out a feature of Gaius' character that was so commendable that it was his Christian service. Gaius was not only saved, but he was used in the extension of God's kingdom. There's nothing so sad as Christians who are blessed with abilities and with resources, but who fail to use them. And that could not be said of Gaius. His part in the work was generous hospitality to the Christian ministers and evangelists and teachers who passed through the area. He received them into his home, and he entertained them at his own expense. His practical ministry was further proof that he was true to his profession of salvation. The truth of the gospel that he had entered into was not something that was kept hidden, but blossomed out into his Christian service. And such love and action never goes unrewarded. Think of the fine friendships that he would have made. Think of the rich fellowship that he would have had as he heard stories of how the gospel was being spread through the limits of the Roman Empire. But the reward wasn't only on the human level. Gaius' work had been registered in heaven. In Matthew 10:40, Jesus told his disciples that he who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me. So when travelers returned to John and spoke appreciatively of what Gaius had done for them, the secret of Gaius' service was that it was dominated by his love. When John wrote his letter, the Christian church had only a short history behind it, but it already had a clear pattern of responsibility for missionary work, and that had emerged. And just as Jesus sent out the 70 to proclaim the gospel of the kingdom, so the early church sent forth missionaries with the news of Christ's death and resurrection. So these itinerant servants and evangelists did not receive support from the world because they were on Christ's time. The elder wrote in verse 7, "It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from the pagans." This should help us focus our minds on how we need to use our resources. Now, there's so many good causes that Christians may support, and I know many of you support many different good things. But really, we must support our missionaries, whom the world cannot be expected to support, as verse 7 says. It's really a matter of priorities. What comes first? In supporting those engaged in Christian service, we play a part in spreading the gospel. And so we become co-workers with Christ. And what a joy and a privilege it is for us to be able to share in the work of missionaries. And such was Gaius, who served others. But now the tone of John's letter changes as he makes an assessment of another man who was named Diotrephes. And unlike Gaius, who served others, Diotrephes was someone who hindered others. We read about him starting in verse 9. "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will have nothing to do with us. So if I come, I will call attention to what he is doing, gossiping maliciously about us. Not satisfied with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. He also stops those who want to do so and puts them out of the church." Diotrephes was a problem to John. In character and behavior, he's quite different from Gaius. Diotrephes is seen as loving himself more than others and refusing to welcome these traveling evangelists. Yet both men were members of the same congregation. How can something like this happen? Well, Jesus taught his disciples that the kingdom of heaven could be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. Matthew 13:24 talks about this. It says, "But while the men were sleeping, the enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat. It wasn't until the harvest that the weeds were separated from the wheat." And Paul warned Timothy about people connected with the Christian church who held the form of religion, its outward trappings, but they denied the power of it. And this reminds us that members of the visible church are not necessarily part of the true church, the body of Christ. So John's complaint against Diotrephes was multiple. First of all, it was that he was proud and self-willed. Diotrephes is a warning of the characteristics to guard against. kind of like a pen portrait of a man to be avoided, like a poster you'd see in the post office or on a police station notice board of a convicted criminal on the run, which says, you know, this man's dangerous, watch out for him. Diotrephes was somebody who always wanted to be first. He loved the public eye and was always pushing to the front. Behind the scenes work was not just going to work for him. He had to have the limelight. Insufferably proud, and this was the root cause of all of his trouble. John had written to the local church with a message for the members, but Diotrephes and his arrogance had refused to even acknowledge the writer's authority. He may have refused to read the letter to the church, or even destroyed it. Whatever happened, the effect was to reject the instructions that were given by John. You can almost hear him saying, I'm not going to be dictated by John, even though he's some big shot. The name Diotrephes was not a common name. It appears to be found only in families of noble blood. So if that was the case, then it may have been social prestige that was the issue behind his disgraceful behavior. Now, pride is a manifestation of sin. It reveals itself in many different forms. As someone has said, there is the pride of place, there is the pride of face, and there is the pride of grace. Trouble starts when something that's perfectly good, say a person's ability or a person's position or achievement, and then it's given a position of totally out of proportion. Diotrephes had a position of responsibility in the church, but he loved it so much that when John the Elder, who had greater authority over him, overruled him, then this flaw in his character was exposed. Not only was Diotrephes proud and self-willed, but one thing led to another. He was undisciplined and spiteful. The elder complained that Diotrephes was gossiping maliciously against us, as verse 10 says. One can almost imagine him going around to the congregation and trying to put John down and seeking to belittle him in the eyes of others. And this character assassination must have been very harmful to the church fellowship. And how the devil rejoices over this kind of friction, this kind of jealousy, and this kind of competition that can often happen even in the confines of the church. The late C.S. Lewis was a most perceptive writer. In his book, The Screwtape Letters, he imagines he is listening to a speech given by the senior devil in hell itself. And the subject is religion on earth. The devil goes on to say, it can still send us the truly delicious sins. The fine flower of unholiness can grow only in the close neighborhood of the holy. Nowhere do we tempt so successfully as on the very steps of the altar. Diotrephes was not content with a campaign of malicious words against John, but he went further, for we're told that he refused to accept spiritual authority. Diotrephes deliberately defied the elder by turning others away from the church. For some reason, he resented this arrival of traveling preachers. Perhaps he wanted to be the preacher on all the occasions. He may have had a secret fear that if his congregation heard another type of ministry or another type of preaching, that his own would be overshadowed. Regardless of the possible benefit to the church of hearing more experienced teachers than himself, he was determined to bolster up his own position at all costs. He was more concerned with the glory of his own image. And the result of this is that he refused to even have them in his home or to lift a finger to help them. And what was even worse was that if any of the members who didn't see eye to eye with him and actually had an inclination to help these traveling evangelists, well, they became his enemies. Those who wanted to obey John and welcome the itinerant evangelists, he tried to expel them from the church. It must have been very painful for John to write these words and to write such a dreadful report. But he had to do it, and he was honest about what was going on. And he gives us an assessment of this man that we need to watch out for in our work, in our life in the church. But now at the end of this little book, the one chapter book, the mood of sorrow gives place to joy as he turns his attention to an assessment of a third subject, a man who is named Demetrius. Demetrius, we find, was someone who attracted others. In all probability, Demetrius was actually the bearer of John's letters, the one who brought the letter to the church. Now, other people's opinions of us aren't always correct or aren't always all that important, even those who know us best. Only God is all-knowing and all-seeing. But still, what the impartial observer thinks can be a good indicator of what things really are, of who we really are. Self-assessment is valuable, but honestly, it can be pretty biased. Most companies' slogans or commercials portray themselves to be the most honest and the most hardworking companies with the best quality and the best service and the best commitment. And I hope you don't believe every commercial you see. The best recommendation comes from a real individual who can express what a good experience he had in dealing with that company. Well, in the same way, Demetrius was someone who lived out his Christian beliefs in his daily work. And John was able to give Demetrius a good commendation. He doesn't give us a lot of details about why Demetrius was commended, but what he writes is praise indeed when he says in verse 12 that Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone. Of course, it may not always be good when everyone speaks well of us because we may be just following the crowd or just doing something to please people, but in this case it was good. Demetrius' good testimony did not rely only on the words of others. His Christian genuineness was confirmed by the way he lived his life. John the Elder has completed his frank assessment of these three men connected with the early church, and they are given as examples of the qualities that pleases God and the defects that can only cause damage to the person of Christ and to the church. Two good examples and one bad example. The bad example is Diotrephes. He hindered others. He slandered John. He cold-shouldered the missionaries, and he excommunicated the loyal believers who just wanted to do what was right, because he loved himself and he wanted to have preeminence. The question must be asked whether he was a true Christian at all. John warns that he will be obliged to take some kind of disciplinary action. History does not record if John visited the church to deal with the matter personally, but one thing that we can be sure of is that Diotrephes will at least have to give an answer at that last day when confronted with the head of the church, the Lord Jesus Christ, as will all believers. But there were two good examples. Gaius, who served others, he abounded in spiritual health. His life was a visual sermon that rang true because he was dominated by the love of Christ. And Demetrius, who attracted others, he was commended by all who knew him as a true man of God, a worthy ambassador of the Lord that he served. Most of what we learn in life comes by imitating others. It's natural for us to look up to other people as our model and to copy them. And John has made his searching assessment of these men, and he leaves us with these words of counsel in verse 11, when he simply says, "Do not imitate what is evil, but what is good." And so, which example are you going to follow? When you think about how your life impacts others, and everyone's life does impact others, what impact will your life make on a spiritual level? Will you be known as someone who serves others, and thus reflects the love of Christ for them? Will your life be that which attracts others to the Christian life, rather than be something that would actually hinder others from seeking Christ and the Christian life? There's lots of ways to tell the world that you're a Christian, by your words and by your action. As we sing this song, may each of us commit to doing our very best to impact others in a positive way, especially in matters of eternity. And if there happens to be anyone here today who has been impacted by others to the point that you would like to receive Christ as your own Savior, we'd like to give you that opportunity to do so. We're going to sing, "I'll Tell the World That I'm a Christian." And if you'd like to do that, if you'd like to stand up and say to the world, those of us right here, "I want to be a Christian," would you simply get out of your pew, come up to the front and come forward, and we'll help you from there. If there's anyone else who has already made that decision and you'd like to decide to become a member of Spinning Road Baptist Church, we would also invite you to make that decision public by coming forward. We're going to sing number 643, "I'll Tell the World That I'm a Christian." Let's stand together as we sing.